Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So for the last couple of days at tea time, we've been having some really good conversations, and it's interesting that they've all, in my mind, have all kind of connected in many levels, talking about loving-kindness practice, talking about asking for forgiveness. I was just reading an article of Ajahn Jeff's today, kind of based on that, about reconciliation. Kind of a difference between asking for forgiveness and reconciliation. And also thinking in terms of just here in a couple of days will be the end of the traditional rains retreat, the Vasa. And we end the Vasa period, which is, for people that don't know, in the monsoon season in Asia. That's in India, especially during the time of the Buddha, it was difficult for traveling, and so it's also the planting season and destructive for wanderers to be wandering, destroying the roads, making it difficult for people to support the monastics, wandering ascetics, and so it was a culture custom to stay put. And so even though this is our dry season, we still follow the rules based on that. But at the end of that period, that three or four month period, the lay people in the areas would get to know a community and would wish to maybe provide them with the requisites that they might need for their wanderings, because it was mainly a wandering tradition. And so it was kind of the ceremony that developed. And so we'll have what happens for the monastic community is that also the monks have been living together for, say, 3 or 4 months and then parting ways. So there was this ceremony of actually inviting people to point out any shortcomings, any difficulties that there had been. It's a very skillful thing to do, especially if you are going to be traveling. Here the communities are much more stable. I was just kind of contemplating this evening that I think, you know, everybody from all the samaneras up have been here for about, you know, at least 2 years, you know, almost 3 years for most of us, or even longer. You know, so we're a very stable community. But a few of us actually will be starting to travel. The community might be people going off to different monasteries for training to just live in a different environment. You know, I'll be pretty shortly after the end of the rains retreat going up to the Hermitage up in Washington and spending a pretty significant amount of time up there. And so there is this, there will be some coming and goings right now. And so this ceremony that we'll have actually has some real meaning to it, in the sense that it's an opportunity to, when we do part, if we can actually do it, you know, harmoniously and do it skillfully, you know, if there has been any issues, anybody feeling you know, hurt in some way or misunderstood or, you know, just any difficulties, if we're able to solve those before we leave, then we can just, you know, let it go. Then we don't have to carry on the issue. Because oftentimes, if we do carry it on, we'll actually start to remember it incorrectly. We'll start adding to it, you know, just the perceptions change, memories change, you know, might end up making an issue out of something that really isn't an issue. So it's this ceremony is called the Pawarna, just an invitation. And I every year I kind of, you know, take it very seriously and think about it. And I've given several Dhamma talks in the past about, you know, how to give admonishment to people. And the Buddha, he actually gives some quite detailed instructions in the Chulawaga. I think there's like four different lists of five of things that we need to establish in ourselves, questions we need to ask about ourselves before we do that, attitudes we need to set up. And I'll just go through them just kind of briefly, but won't go into them in detail. But I think like the most important ones are it's actually not even one of the lists, but as part of our rules, is that if we do want to bring up an issue with somebody, we need to ask permission of that person to do it, which I think is very skillful in the fact that it kind of prepares the other person and it honors them in the sense of just sort of coming up to somebody and start pointing out all their faults, but it gives them an opportunity to prepare their mind to hear what you have to say. Because you can just imagine, if someone comes up to you, just out of the blue in any situation and says, hey, can I point out something you're doing wrong? It's like it can be a closing of the heart, a sense of protecting yourself. And so you're not that receptive. So just to asking the person for permission and then being open to actually the person, saying, no, they don't want to talk about it. Or more likely what might happen is the person will, say, yeah, I'd like to sit down and discuss this, but, can we do it, at this particular time, setting some boundaries. Or I've actually seen it happen too, where the person actually wanted a mediator there as well. Like they knew it was an issue and they asked if, one of the senior monks could be present for listening in on it. So it just, honors the person in that way. Also too, finding the right time to bring up even asking to do that sort of situation of admonishing someone, before you just sort of jump in and ask to find the right time to do that. And there are certain times of the day most of us know or on your own that are more stressful, like times during the work period or especially right before, right after the work period when things are busy, or right before the meal. It's usually not a good time. Also too, in a crowded situation, not to embarrass somebody. I use these same guidelines if I'm ever wanting to ask for forgiveness for something that I've done, looking at the right time. So like if I've done something unskillful or used harsh speech or been impolite, it's probably best not to try to ask for forgiveness right in the moment, especially when the person might be still in reaction to you and or having their own emotions stirred up. So it's best to wait till that person is the situation is calmed down, and maybe you're talking about something in a completely different context, and you notice the person doesn't seem to be holding any ill will or sort of grudge or fear around what maybe you had done in a situation like that. Then you just kind of feel it out, and say, okay, well this seems safe, and then just ask at that time if I'm asking for forgiveness, I would do it at that point. But kind of taking the same consideration and when asking somebody to point out anything, just making sure that it's the person's in a receptive mood. And then I think it's important to keep it factual, so it's not like this is something like you have a habit of doing this. It's being more last week when you said you would do this, you didn't. Just sort of very very factual, and that then the person can actually hear it, and they can intellectually kind of respond to it instead of more being theoretical, which can tend to have judgments and projections maybe put into it. So if you keep it factual, but then the a lot of the attitudes with it are to be coming from a mind of goodwill, of not doing it out of spite. You were mean to me, so I'm going to be mean back to you. Or they give you some negative feedback, so you jump in and give them some of your own. So watching it and just setting up the mind of goodwill in why you would even be presenting it to somebody. One of the things might be that it's just a real desire for that person to learn, to if they are going to be in a monastic community for a long time, there are certain expectations or behaviors that are more beautiful, and maybe the person has a blind spot, and then you can you can point these things out. So it's a having that desire to keep everybody on the the same page in terms of monastic etiquette and keeping things harmonious in that particular way. Another, getting off the list of five, but if someone is actually sort of bringing up an issue with us, the Buddha recommended sort of two pieces of advice for the person receiving the feedback. One is to, unless the person is, you can really tell that they do have, some ill will involved in it, then, then you should actually accept the invitation. And again, you can sort of set conditions on it, like, let's sit down at tea time, or you sit down with somebody else if you don't feel safe. But he does encourage us to accept that invitation. But then when you do, to keep in mind actually what is the truth of the situation. And so if the person is presenting something that is truthful, that is factual, that you can actually see the fault, then it's actually a blessing that somebody was willing to, sit down and point these things out to you. It might be unpleasant. We never like to have things pointed out to us that are unskillful on our part. So you can look at it as, well, that person really had a lot of confidence in me. They had a lot of trust that I could listen to this and accept that. So you can look at it as a gift. So that's the first one. Looking, to see what's the truth of the situation, and then the second point is to really work at not becoming provoked. Not the reaction might be embarrassment, or the person actually may have gotten the situation wrong. They may be accusing you of something you didn't do, and you might think it's right to stand up and defend yourself. And You can easily imagine where maybe some frustration or anger could arise. And so the Buddha says, in situations like that, or even if the person actually is correct, but you're kind of embarrassed maybe that they're bringing it up, just to try to stay as calm as you can in receiving it. I was telling one of the guests who just recently arrived that when I went to Thailand, Ajahn Amara's advice to me was to ask for admonishment. You ask for it. And these three pieces of advice were, not to ask for anything when you get there in terms of like material possessions, not to, to go, thinking through as much as you can what you're going to need, what's appropriate for that situation, and then try to get by with what you have. The second piece of advice was then to offer assistance, as much as you could, try to be as helpful as you can. And then the third one was to ask for feedback, ask for admonishment. I tell the story many times, but it was really fun that the first two or three days that I was there, because the etiquette there is completely different. Well, not completely, but different situations and different ways that they do things there. And of course, I didn't know any of the ways that they practice there. And so it was like the first morning, just within like a 5-minute span, I like broke like three or four rules of the monastery. And if somebody would come up to me and say, "Oh, Jody Paul, you don't sit on the asana like a chair. You either sit on it like in meditation, or go sit someplace else in a chair." And I was like, "Oh, thank you. Yeah, I didn't know that. But if you see me do anything else wrong, please let me know." And usually when you give people, say feedback, it's kind of negative. There can be some, resistance to hearing that. And so they were kind of surprised that I was actually asking for more. So I got up to put my robe on, and I just stood up right in front of the asana and started putting my robe on. And someone comes up, "Jody Paulo, we don't put our robes on standing right in front of the asana. There's people sitting, right behind you. It's better to, move away from the asana." I was like, "Oh, thank you. I didn't know that was the rule, but thanks for pointing that out. If you see me do anything else wrong, please let me know." And so I walk into the middle of the hall, Jodi Paul, you don't put your robes on and stand in the middle of the hall, especially in front of the Buddha image, and you go to the back of the hall. Oh, thank you for pointing that out. I didn't know that. If you see me doing anything else wrong, please let me know. So it became a sort of like people were trying to find fault with me so they could hear me say this. You know, they just thought it was cute. But then I think within 3 days, like I said, I got like 90% of the core Wat down because people were not afraid to come up and point things out to me. But if, you know, those first 3 times people had said something, if I had, you know, yelled at them or got angry or, you know, how was I supposed to know that? We don't do that at Abhayagiri. It's not the, we don't do that at Abhayagiri. Then people would have, you know, been much, much more hesitant of pointing anything out. So that you know, staying unprovoked can have some real blessings. So this, say this afternoon at our tea time, I'd already been thinking about, you know, these kinds of issues and talking about forgiveness and also, say, with loving-kindness practice. And one thing I was pointing out was a couple of years ago, I gave a talk in Minnesota, and it was advertised in advance, and it was it's a really good meditation group that Ajahn Chah Dukho has. He's known the people there for quite a long time, so it's a really good meditation group. And but I titled the talk "Metta Practice for People Who Hate Doing Metta," and it was extremely well attended. And just even, you know, sort of, you know, bringing up the title in at the beginning of that talk, you know, everybody kind of burst out laughing, and it was like, oh, so we kind of hit a chord here, you know, with that topic. And say this kind of ties into me with the article on reconciliation and forgiveness practices, and partly is a couple months ago, I think I was down in Berkeley and I was talking about that's the same subject of why people have aversion to doing metta practice, and one of the people was listening to one of my points, and you know, her comment was that. Her obstacle, or what was the obstacle she had in developing loving kindness, was that she needed to practice self forgiveness, and when she actually sort of took that on as a practice, then it you know, completely changed the tone of it and opened up the practice. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about, you know, this tonight, that whole topic and subject. So with the metta, I think the very first strike, I think, that for myself that had was just the English translation of the word. Even when I talk about it or think about it, I still, the word loving kindness comes into my head. It's just, it's so deep in the Buddhist culture that metta is loving kindness. And then most of us here have heard or read, you know, Ajahn Jeff's article that you know, titled, I think it's you know, "Metta is Goodwill," and that's really helped me, you know, quite a bit, you know, in seeing it in that light. You know, even when I was, you know, in the very beginning, when I was studying this or doing meditation retreats on metta, you know, I was hearing different translations. And like, I remember Stephen Smith was talking about somehow in the Burmese language that metta has this sort of connotation of, he was calling it like a water drop connection. He said it's sort of like a, you know, binding of the heart, or a, you know, sort of entering into relationship. And he said the image that they have in Burma is this water drop connection. He said it's like if you take two pieces of paper that are completely dry, and you just set them on top of each other, like a wind blows, they blow away. So there's no connection, there's no bonding, there's no relationship at all there. But if you just take a single drop of water and, you know, drop it on the first piece of paper and then set the second one on it, just a single drop of water will act as like this adhesive that you know, can attract the objects so that they can stay in relationship. And so I find that a really interesting image to use when thinking of metta. Also, Bhante Gunaratna, I think his translation of it is loving friendliness. So just, you know, using that the concept of friendliness, being a friend to yourself and being a friend to some to another person. That analogy doesn't totally work for me, because when you go through the different categories of, say, the enemy, it's kind of hard to be, you know, to think of the enemy as a friend. But in terms of doing it to yourself or to the qualities you know, of ourself or a teacher or even a neutral person, you know, I think that can work, of thinking them as a friend. Also, the images of loving kindness is being non-discriminatory. It's like this sort of opening of the heart. And the analogy I've often heard is it's like the sun shining. And so it's like the sun doesn't discriminate on who or what it's shining on. So it shines on you equally as to your best friend, to someone who's a neutral person to you, to somebody that you don't like. You know, if you're all standing out here in the courtyard on a sunny day, you're all going to be feeling the same loving kindness, the same sunshine. I like that image of it, you know, radiating onto everybody equally. It takes out the sense of judgment and, you know, fault finding, or, you know, I like this one and not that one. It permeates everybody. So the very first strike I had, against loving kindness was just not really fully understanding, you know, what the word meant. And so I think, you know, all of these, when I take that into consideration and, you know, seeing it as goodwill, then it really changes it for me. And I've mentioned this before, but it was with living with Ajahn Siddhanta a couple of years ago when I was at the Pacific Hermitage. We were, you know, looking at the Metta Sutta in detail, and you know, the one place in the entire sutta where it actually in the Pali actually uses the word metta, it refers to it as you know, not having ill will. And you know, we were talking about this, and it's like, you know, oh, you know, it's like the phrase came to my mind is, I can do that. You know, I can actually have that as an attitude of wishing not to yet to do something unskillful, or to, it's not even, you know, wishing somebody well. Like, I don't have to be going around, you know, wishing everybody, oh, may you be happy, may you be safe, but just not wishing for them their downfall, not wishing for someone to suffer. I use the example right before the end of tea time of, you know, going in to wash the dishes, and like, if it's somebody there that you really don't like, you know, like, you can see this, you know, that probably happens for some people. Like, if there's someone you really don't like and they're carrying a, you know, dish or something like that with, you know, kind of precariously carrying, I think, yeah, I, you know, hope they drop that and falls on them, you know. You know, you can sometimes get into that. Nobody here, of course, would ever have that thought, but you can wish ill on somebody, or, you know, like if you're a sports fan, you know, wish the other team to, you know, their best player who's killing your team, you know, wish for their, you know, to have an injury or something so they can't play in the game. You know, it's a thought of ill will. But you can, you know, develop the thought of just non-ill will. You know, like, you don't have to want the other team to win the game, or, but yet, but you can keep the mind from going into a negative state, and even that is loving kindness. People often ask, well, where does, you know, say the Brahmaviharas or the loving kindness show up in the Buddhist teachings in terms of, like, say, the Four Noble Truths? Well, it shows up in the path factors, the fourth noble truth, and it's the right intention, which is the second factor. And so it's the intention of having non-ill will, non-cruelty, and renunciation. So that's sort of where the Buddha points out that these are the mind states that you know, are really needed for us to develop concentration and wisdom. So non-cruelty is the negative way of saying compassion. So it's just not wishing or doing anything cruel to somebody. And so the positive of that is compassion. And then non-ill will, the opposite, is loving-kindness or goodwill, metta. And then renunciation is the third. When doing loving kindness, there's several things that I've sort of myself have pointed or have pinpointed of why I think people find it a difficult practice or one they have aversion towards, is that the instructions that I'm using and following now is that, you know, what metta is that intention, the intention not to have ill will towards somebody. And, you know, but stating it in a positive, so when I use it as meditation, it's, you know, starting with myself, it's, you know, may I be safe, may I be happy. And if you're using phrases like that, and, you know, you really put some meaning into it, you contemplate what that would mean, what would your life look like if you actually were safe, if you were happy, imagining situations where you are safe or you are happy. And when you start doing these things and just even repeating those phrases, just keeping negative thoughts out, just by keeping the positive thought there, there can be this sort of sense of warmth, sort of just appreciation that you're doing something skillful, you're doing something wholesome. And there can be this warm feeling that arises. For some people, it's a cool feeling, but for me, it's this kind of warm glow. And you learn to be able to raise that up in any situation, and to be able to not only bring it up, but to make it last longer, and to be able to, you know, to stay with that feeling for, you know, as long as you wish for that feeling to be there. But my suspicion is, and this is definitely what happened for me, was that people mistake that feeling as being metta. So then you're doing the phrases, you have the intention, and, you know, the feeling comes up, and then we switch the attention from the phrases or from the intention to the feeling. But the feelings in and of themselves aren't what caused the metta to arise. It's really the intention. It's the intention to, you know, wish well for somebody else, or to wish well for yourself. And so then I think what happens is that then, you know, so you develop it, you maybe take some time. It's actually quite interesting. It could even be fun to develop it at the beginning. Usually a new skill is interesting. So the mind is applied to it, and then the feeling arises, so you get some positive feedback, and you're kind of excited about it, and then you turn the attention to that feeling and it disappears. And you're like, okay, you know, yeah, this is new, because, you know, so I just need to develop it again. So you develop it again, you know, it arises again, then you switch the attention, then it fades again. And you do this over and over again, and it just gets very frustrating. And you might even think, well, I'm just somebody who can't, this isn't the right practice for me. This is something that's, you know, you don't have to be skilled in every single meditation subject. And so you can have doubts about your ability to do it. And actually in that situation, that's a good doubt, because if it's being held the wrong way, then it's not a good practice to do, because it does get exhausting and it gets frustrating. But if you hold the right intention, that it is just to have the intention and then to use the phrases, then you can use the feelings in a skillful way as a guidepost that the intention is correct, the effort that you're putting in is the right intensity. So you can use the feelings skillfully, but it's not in and of itself, that's not the metta. So I think that's another, you know, big reason that it becomes difficult. And then for myself, the biggest obstacle is that when I was able to develop this in the early stages of the practice, I was using loving kindness as a way not to feel. If I was doing something unskillful, or, you know, anything associated with greed, hatred, or delusion, that was, you know, somewhere in my consciousness, maybe not even fully conscious, but underneath the surface, that was, you know, draining energy. And you know, maybe just trying to bubble up and come into my consciousness, I could just develop this loving kindness, this feeling of, you know, but it's actually, it can be quite blissful, the feeling. And so it just drowns out any of the other negative states that might be there. And so later I started referring to them as metta bombs, just to sort of explode any sort of negative feelings that I had, just obliterate it. I don't want to deal with this. So I'll just, you know, I don't want to look at that situation, and so I'll just love it to death and get rid of it. And that's where I was talking about that point at Berkeley, and this woman said that, you know, she had that kind of same, you know, but for her, instead of you know, to me, it was like, you know, I actually had to look at that of like, you know, why was I you know, trying to obliterate those things and not feel those feelings. You know, for me, it was coming here. It was actually about the same time that I was actually I was using that as a technique, and until I came here as an anagarika, and it was almost immediately, as soon as I became an anagarika, I wasn't able to get into that those sensations anymore. And you know, at the time, I just wrote it off as like, well, everything is new here. There's, you know, a whole new way we practice. There's you know, so many things to learn, and just, I just felt that the mind was probably more interested in other techniques. But there was, every time I would try to do loving kindness, there was this major aversion would come up, and I could see that it was just needing, you know, to overcome those negative mind states that were there. It just required more and more and more energy to develop that loving kindness, till I got to a point where it just wasn't possible. And that's where that was the feeling of negativity. And so then, you know, I think like living here, living, you know, really strictly on precepts and taking on the, say, the third part of the right intention of renunciation, really, you know, picking up those vows as an anagarika, you know, really forces you to look at the negative qualities. So it's like, you know, the way I saw it really clearly was that, you know, as a layperson, whenever I was feeling, you know, aversion or craving, especially aversion, like I actually didn't realize I was, you know, I had so much aversion until I became an anagarika. The story I always tell was the kitchen was only half the size of what it is right now, and we had about 10 people on the day before Wanprak cleaning, and I was really averse to being in that, such a small space with so many people. And so I was cleaning the stove, just one corner of the stove with my back to everybody else. And then all of a sudden, this desire for a donut arised in my mind. And I realized, oh, that's how I've been living my life. You know, like whenever there's any sort of desire or aversion, you know, I could just, I could, you know, drown it out with something pleasant, like watching a movie or listening to music, and not ever having to face it. And as a layperson, you know, I was fortunate. I was fairly well off. So, you know, if I had a desire to do something, I could usually almost immediately fulfill it. I could just go out and buy something or do something or go someplace or call up friends. And so I never had to look at it. And as a consequence, I never even knew they were there, because I could just almost immediately get rid of them. So then, yeah, coming here, you know, I think there were so, you know, the precepts really prevented me from falling into those. And then that meant then to, you know, overcome those feelings without looking at them, I had to, you know, use the metta practice even more. And then that's why it probably became unsustainable, because that was like the only, that and sleep were the only two ways of not feeling. Overeating, sleep, and, you know, trying to do the metta practice, in all of those, you know, stop working. And so, you know, here then, you know, the practice of, you know, mindfulness and the more of the, you know, breath meditation, those became the tools for doing that. And then I mentioned at tea time, and I've given a couple of talks on then really confronting the aversion, was to look at you know, my actions of, especially of body and, you know, speech, body and speech. And if I did anything that I saw that was, you know, caused harm, and it was really, was really paying attention to my own intention. Like if I acted in a way that I knew was unskillful and, or, you know, had a negative thought and acted on it, I just made a real strong determination for an entire year. I made the determination for 1 year to ask forgiveness if I had done that. And that's where I started the, you know, looking at those traits of, you know, how to admonish somebody, but then turning that into myself, like, you know, finding the right time, asking permission, One of the really skillful ones is in admonishing somebody is to ask if you're free of those faults yourself. Because oftentimes we can find is like if we have aversion towards something, it's there's a good chance we might be doing something similar ourselves. It was just reading something where like somebody was saying like if, as soon as you bring something into your consciousness, you start noticing everywhere. So like at tea time, he used the example of just said the word yellow, and then all of a sudden you start noticing like right before I said that, if your eyes are open, you probably didn't notice. You know, the yellow walls, the yellow in the floor, the yellow of the candles, the yellow of the, so yellow is everywhere, now that I've mentioned it, and the mind seeks it out. So like if in some place in your consciousness you're doing something unskillful, it is there, and you start noticing it all around you. So this this practice of, asking, am I free of that same fault is there's probably, there could be, it's not necessarily true, but there could be the sense that there are some aspect of that we're at fault for the same thing. With the conversation at tea time about, having aversion towards loving kindness, it's also true that that loving kindness isn't the right practice for everybody. It doesn't actually have to be a practice that we do. There might be cultural baggage that we have with it. People may have told us things about it, or just that sort of sense of, with loving kindness, it's always traditionally taught to start with yourself. And, particularly in Western culture, there can be the sense of, that we shouldn't be sort of selfish that way, to be always thinking about ourselves. And so there can be, it could be a completely new experience to even thinking of ourselves in a positive way. And that can bring up fear, can bring up aversion. In a situation like that, I've heard if you are doing, you are wanting to develop loving kindness, then to start with whatever is easiest to bring it up with. So even, I've even heard like even using an inanimate object, if that is what helps you to be able to connect with the subject. But I was, contemplating too with the sort of reconciliation and asking for forgiveness with the practice of compassion, the second of the Brahma Viharas. With that practice, you actually don't start with yourself. So it's like if part of our aversion to doing loving kindness is that maybe there is something we need to investigate in ourselves, or maybe there is something that we need to develop compassion for ourselves. Maybe we've done or said something or have attitudes that that we're actually fearful of. If we do open the heart with, say, loving kindness, that we will be reminded of these negative things maybe we've done or said, or even just being afraid of what might come up, even though we've maybe not done anything unskillful, but it's an unknown. And maybe we've had experiences in the past where we've opened up to new things and had a bad experience. It may be nothing to do with loving kindness or anything to do with morality or anything, but just the fear of the unknown. And so looking at compassion. And so like with compassion, you don't start with yourself, but you start with typically it's with somebody who's in great suffering. You can look at somebody and clearly see that they're being, say, physically tortured or just a lot of physical pain, someone who it's very easy to bring up compassion for. And I just started really kind of contemplating this, why would that be? Wouldn't you start compassion for yourself? One obvious reason is that if you see someone really, really in physical pain, then that is a natural movement of the heart. And so you can tune into that and to get to know what that experience feels like, and kind of purify that feeling, that intention of, so not wanting to add to the cruelty of that person. Because I think it can actually be the sort of sense in people that haven't trained or haven't cultivated, like to see somebody who's down, somebody who's in pain, and to actually like some this instinct to actually, you know, inflict more on it, onto a situation like that. So it's like to look at that and to, you know, just have that real strong intention not to add to it, you know, and actually wishing for that person's well-being, you know, wishing for them to, for that suffering to end. And, you know, if you start with this practice, you know, like when you do, you move on to doing yourself, it's like, it's usually just like with metta, there's a whole complex list of phrases that you can use. And with all the other Brahmaviharas, it's usually just like a single phrase or two. And so with compassion practice, it can just be, you know, if you're doing it for yourself, it's, you know, like, you know, may I be free of suffering and pain. Or I think it was Ajahn Suchito, it was one of the phrases I think he uses is something like, I can endure this pain, or may I feel safe, you know, exploring this pain. It's good just to look at any of the, you know, just try out different phrases and you know, from different angles, different approaches. So I kind of like that, like even like I'm strong enough to look at this pain, or may I be strong enough to look at this pain, or you know, may I be free of pain. Yeah, so in general, yeah, the feeling, say aversion to doing loving kindness. Yeah, I do feel like if that you know, does come up for us, there's probably something that we're holding wrong. Because, like, you know, all of the Brahmaviharas, you know, they're called Brahmaviharas because they are like heavenly mind states that the Buddha, you know, says that they're, you know, kind of always wholesome, you know, and always skillful. If we're, you know, they may not always be the appropriate response, but if one of those four will always be an appropriate response to situations. Yeah, like say, you know, having aversion towards say loving kindness. I was just, you know, at tea time I was giving some examples of, you know, seeing loving kindness. Well, yeah, that's the one of the last points too, is that why I think people have aversion towards loving kindness is that it's always been taught to me that we send loving kindness. It's even in all the chants, you know, I will abide pervading one quarter, and the way I've been practicing it is that we don't actually send it. We're cultivating the loving kindness. I won't get into the details of it, but you're cultivating that feeling, learning to bring it up, learning to sustain the feeling, and then when we start doing other people, we're actually inviting them into our consciousness. We're not sending it to them, but we're allowing the thought of somebody else. You know, like imagine, like you're feeling the sense of safety, at ease, and then bringing up the concept or the thought of somebody that's been very mean to you. You know, and how can you, you know, have that person in your consciousness and not close down? So it's a practice more of that than of actually sending. But I really do believe that the sending does actually happen. Like there is a, you know, that energy does move in the universe, and you can affect people. And so I think if you're just trying to develop it and cultivate it, and you get a little bit of it going, and then all of a sudden you try sending it to somebody on the other side of the world, it's very draining, and it can be almost the same thing of when you've cultivated it and then you switch the attention to the feeling, how it subsides. So that same way can be quite draining if you're developing it, but you're giving it away as soon as you get it. It's almost as if you need that energy of raising the energy, of, you know, cultivating and having it there to keep the mind on it for a, you know, extended period of time. That, you know, you need the energy and you can't be sending it. So if we are sending it, I think it can just make it more difficult, and then again make it frustrating. And so just end pretty quickly here, but with the end of the rains retreat happening, and say people will be coming and going, I think these are, you know, some good just things to keep in mind, especially the beginning part of, you know, if we do feel like it's appropriate or needed to, you know, to talk to somebody. But just, you know, really keeping in mind those factors, and, you know, they are in the the BMC monastic code in the Sangari Sesa section for admonishing. You can review on those, or but just also just keeping that sense of goodwill, and if you do say need to say anything, to say it in a way that will be of benefit to everybody. So I'll leave that for our reflection this evening.